Okay, let's go.
Set and action.
It was a long process because every single little thing had to be designed to try to respect the spirit in the Frank Herbert's book.
It's a luxury to have that vision and not so much rely on your imagination. It's pretty great.
When the camera lands, look at the camera and say, Neil.
3, 2, 1, go.
Neil.
I think there was an expansiveness to these sets. From an acting perspective, you could just feed off of with ease. It didn't feel like we were shooting on a stage or a studio.
I read the script and I can't help it. Images come to mind, like strong images. I create mood boards with references, with little sketches, and I bring them to Denis. So for him, it's important to make this movie his vision. So we try to make something very different from what's been done before.
I'm a strong believer that you must build as much as possible because it will influence acting, it will influence the imagination of the actors, it will influence myself as a director. Tons of ideas are being born right on the day on set because the way the light falls, it changes your way to approach reality when you are in a real environment.
They come from a land in Caladan. It's a bit more cozy. You could almost smell the fireplace going, and it's all integrated in nature. For me, Caladan is what we would, you know, relate to as a medieval castle. It's also a big contrast with Arrakis.
When Paul Atreides lands on Arrakeen, he's confronted to a new kind of architecture that looks nothing like his home. It's designed to resist the worst sandstorm, and the way to deal with heat is like to have like those thick walls and to have like those huge space.
Talk about scale. Yes. The size of it needs to be oppressive. And behind us, we have the mural of the sandworm. The idea is to have murals that show art, that shows their type of culture on the planet. Here you've got the god figure of the sandworm. Let me take you to Paul's bedroom, which is a work in progress at the moment. But this is the bed. For me, it was important to have this sense of someone who is being squeezed and could be crushed at any moment.
Patrice Vermette had to be very, very creative with space. The set were like transformers, you know, and you can transform them and change them according to the sequences.
This room will play two rooms. It will be Duncan's room, and it's also going to be Leto's room. And right now we are dressing Leto's room. This is something that Denis and I, we wanted this place to be a bunker. The residency needs to convey the feeling of a bunker because the wind on Arrakis, they go at 880 kilometers an hour. So it's natural that they wanted to build something that would stand the force of nature. Very little windows or very limited view of windows because they want to protect themselves from the heat. Keep, you know, always the coolness of inside a cave. The furniture and the pieces are so bang on. Just like the shape perfectly fitted for this room. The carpet, you know, without that carpet, the room, you know, it's just a plain floor.
The carpets were made in Denmark by this amazing company that digitally print onto carpet. It was a local company here in Budapest that we went through. So they're real carpets, and then we aged them down as well.
It really helps give a cultural aspect to the space.
The production design is futuristic, but it's ancient to go wander through those places. I've learned so much on this. It's a beautiful thing.
The detail. The art department, hands up to them. It's just exquisite, the work that they've done. It's like doing one of those biblical CinemaScope Technicolor films from back in the day.
And action.
We're in Kynes Lab, which is basically a research center where they're basically trying to get life on Arrakis. So it's about how you grow things in sand or with lack of moisture. Looked at scientific equipment, weird stuff, and also then just tried to link it in with a reality, like that's the equivalent of a grow light. Denny didn't want anything that looked remotely like it was from a lab that he recognized. The guys are working at the studio for us, made everything.
This is just one room, and it's based, I saw early on in my research, Second World War bunkers. It was like a one main corridor and multiple circular chambers around. It's an ancient lab, and in the main office, there are ancient writing, but if you look at the in the texture, I wanted to have some writing that almost is camouflaged in the texture of the rock. So it's the layers of the past, it's the knowledge from this planet, and it represents the culture that has been invaded by the empires.
It was a tremendous amount of work that was made by Patrice and his team. We worked very hard to create something that has not been seen before, which is not easy.
It's very smooth working with Denis. We have the same love for filmmaking. We agree on aesthetics. He's a passionate man. To be invited to work on a movie like this is beyond any dreams. So, yeah, I'm very grateful for that.
Dune took years to be made because it was a challenge to respect the spirit of Frank Herbert's book and bring it to the big screen. Maybe the most important thing of all, I wanted the design to be inspired by nature. The light, the wind, the dust, to feel that these worlds, these were real natural environments.
Frank's book, as a world builder, he created this whole epic. Because I knew Denis really wanted to honor the book, so I would sort of triangulate between Denis' words, Frank's passages, and try to inform how to go forward with my designs. I read in Frank's words, in his passages, that there was 200-mile-an-hour winds, and everything was really designed to deal with this brutal environment of Arrakis. It's almost like solving a puzzle, how to make those into something you've never seen before in a movie.
What I would do is just deal with very simple shapes and maybe just a little detail on the side, just to give you a sense of scale. That was very interesting in terms of trying to design something that made sense.
When Paul Atreides lands on Arrakeen, he's confronted to a new planet. A planet, the most converted and most dangerous planet in the galaxy.
From a color perspective, Denis wanted Arrakis to be harsh and desolate.
It's everything that's on Arrakis is all like stone, brown, sand color.
In the past, I shot in Jordan, and I remember 10 years ago saying to myself, wow, if ever the day I make a movie like Dune, that's where I'm coming. There are unique, fantastic rock formations that look like from another world.
Look what we discovered on lunch break. I've never seen a desert like that. I'm a rock climber. I've never seen rock like that.
The light is absolutely unique in that place. The surroundings, the color of the soil, the sky. It feels like there's very much a spirituality that exists there.
When you're on Arrakis, it's a hot, desert, arid environment. So it's a very, very strong light, and it's something you can't reproduce in the studio. Arrakeen is actually based on an actual area in Wadi Rum. It was scouted by a helicopter, and we found this area where, like, it's surrounded by mountains. We would previs certain moves going into Arrakeen. We did rough geometry of the area, and then we created a rough flight path.
So the city itself needed to be a monument. We wanted to tell a story with that. This is a city that needed to feel like it was populated, and that there were native Arrakeen citizens going about their daily lives within it. The city itself as a character was very important to Denis. We had an opportunity to let him design his own cameras to fly over the city. and we were able to build a low-resolution version of the city, place it on an iPad for him to walk around and be able to design his own camera angle, as if he was shooting it live action from a helicopter.
City elements were shot in Budapest. The soundstage were like two football fields. We recreated a gigantic tarmac for the Atreides landing. So that for the set extension to create the city, we had to use sand screens. We found when you put the sand screen in the negative, it becomes blue. So it's an inverted blue screen.
It works really well for when you're out in the desert as well, because you just invert it and you're already in that color.
We're good to go.
Dune is a movie about nature. It was very important for me to be as close as possible with nature itself. The desert gave us a lot. We captured it with the cameras, and I'm very proud of what we brought back from there. Some elements of the movie are closer to our reality, so the audience can rely to the humanity and to the drama of the characters. And the Enretapter is one of the elements that I choose to go in that direction. In the book, it's described as kind of a plane that uses a propelling system that looks like a bird. Ornithopter. It's like a kind of challenge to bring that to the screen because it can either look fantastic or very silly.
I love how kind of childish everyone is when it comes to talking about these incredible things, ornithopters that look like flying bugs and beetles.
To make this a reality, we started back in February 2018 with Denis, and George Hall came along. And then we conceptualized this first version of the ornithopter. We had insect references, we had bird references, we got helicopter references. And then as we went along, we had like more angular references for the world of Dune.
The biggest challenge was Frank described something that flapped and, you know, this futuristic propulsion on Arrakis. I think it was because of the outlawing of thinking machines. So he wanted something kind of low tech. So I would start doing these little sketches and then start kind of really the designing the mechanics of it first and then making that into a shape. What I have in front of me are some examples of my final ornithopter illustration. But the process goes from sketch to drawing, then I will model it in 3D, then come back to drawing, get notes from Denis that may be more otherworldly or more functional.
I was trying to get closer to the idea of an insect instead of a bird, because there will be a feeling of power and a feeling that will look more realistic. We were getting closer to a dragonfly cross-mix with a helicopter.
Technically, it flaps its wing, but ours is just like a very, very fast movement, almost like a vibration, just like a hummingbird or a dragonfly.
I work with Patrice and also another artist named Coley Wirtz, who took from my beginning designs and took it to the next level, where, you know, really figured out all the details and worked with BGI to build them full size on set. We had to figure out every nut and bolt on this thing for the actors to be inside and out.
They've been constructed in such a way that when you're next to them, the amount of detail that they have is amazing. I was just blown away, really.
I said to Patrice, I want them to look as real as possible. I want my mother to believe that this thing can fly for real. I want it to obey to gravity laws. I want it to feel muscular. I don't want it to be necessarily elegant. I want it to be like bulky and powerful machine that looks like a military helicopter.
These machines, they work into extreme condition on Arrakis. There's winds at 850 kilometers an hour. So you cannot have something that is small and very delicate. You need to be tough, you know, and they are beasts, you know, they're big, especially when they were indoors in London. They look huge and quite impressive. The wingspans are 129 feet, and this one is 75 feet long, and 11 tons, which created its load of problems because they need to be on cranes, they need to be flying.
Sir, stand by to go, guys, please.
Worm sign warning, acknowledge.
who calls Delta Ajax Niner. So does anyone of these seem to be shot in IMAX? This is why the cockpit is in tears, because when the cover is not there, you see the world in there. Also, because of the angles of the glass, you're totally submersed by the desert. It's also to give the spectator an interesting point of view.
I think of the excellent skill level of Patrice at the ornithopter, which felt like a real thing. It felt like, you know, something that you wanted to strap into, you wanted to put your seatbelt on.
Paul, we're not high enough!
The job in CG was to add any wings, especially if it needed to animate, to open up and then to fly. And there was a lot of work done in animation to get a range of motion as to how this ornithopter flies, because obviously there are some dramatic scenes where, like, it dives down and it's highly maneuverable. Also, like, you have people on, like, Duncan Idaho, who, like, you wanted to give it, like, a certain swagger as well as he flew. One thing which we did do to try and keep things believable is that we did a lot of helicopter work. The idea being that you'd have your camera helicopter shooting an ornithopter, you know, and that way, like, you then use lenses specific because, like, you're actually shooting it for real, you know. And, like, you never get too close that, like, you never get any of those CG shots, which are highly unlikely.
There's so many ideas in the movie that are complex, are foreign, are strange, that I wanted the audience to have some ground at some place so they can feel some kind of familiarity. And we came up with that shape that I deeply love, that is very unique.
High desert. My Arrakis. My Dune.
The character of the Baron is a very small role, but if you gave him enough physicality, you could create such a strong presence that he would sort of cast a shadow over the entire film, which is necessary for a bad guy.
I said that you could join her. So join her.
I needed an actor with that gravitas, with that range, that will be able to bring the deep intelligence of the Baron and the cruelty. And I will say right from the start that as much Stellan is the loveliest guy, still I'm frightened of him. He's very frightening.
When is a gift not a gift?
He's not only very gracious, but I can tell that he's a hard worker because of the makeup that he's had to put up with and go through and still be able to perform.
He is so imposing in his makeup and his look. The first time I saw him in his look was the first time I met him. And I was like, oh my God. It's incredible.
If the Duke's son lives,
now our traitors will live.
His performance is what makes that transformation believable.
So it's done, finally.
We did a tremendous amount of research and design in order to find that shape that will define the Baron.
I had long discussions with Denis about where I wanted to go with it, and that he looked different, that he had a presence that you hadn't seen before.
I didn't want the Baron to look like a caricature. I wanted a strength and power, and I wanted to feel a menace. One of the first decisions I made about the Baron is that we will not use CGI, but the prosthetics. Because I wanted the actor to be in relationship directly with the character.
It's a huge undertaking. I spoke to Denis about it and said, you know, Luve and Eva, the makeup designers in Sweden, would be my choice to create this. And Stellan was very happy with the idea.
Thankfully, they're living in Sweden. And we started doing tests very early on. And they're fantastic. They're some of the best special effect makeup people in the world.
We took Stellan in for a live cast, and we did a full body live cast. And we started doing a sculpt of the entire character.
If you have the full makeup, it's 7 hours. And it's physically hard. Mentally, I can do it because it's fun watching them work.
So the first thing is, in the morning, he puts the cooling suit on.
And then we pull this neck on top of him. It's like a big donut piece that goes on top. And after that, we put this headpiece.
The big thing is, of course, the change of the face and the shoulders and all that. That is very, very delicate.
I mean, normally, the stuntman doesn't wear it more than 1 hour.
No, that's
fine. I can easily do it too, because I'm not a sissy.
Yeah, he's a real man.
Yeah.
And then we put on his undersuit.
Yeah, this is the fun part.
And then you have the fat skin on, and then the edges between the skin and your fake hands and your fake head has to be hand-painted in, and it's a very complicated process.
7 hours later. A lifetime.
It required a lot of patience from Stellan, and I'm still grateful that Stellan didn't complain.
Okay, sure, no problemo.
And I've never seen his demeanor be anything other than pleasant and gracious, and that says a lot, because I know from wearing makeup in the past that it's just not a comfortable thing.
That's very good.
And I also think that he does enjoy it.
Yeah.
He does enjoy becoming the Baron.
It was mesmerizing to see the Baron come to life. He was quite frightening.
Tonight the house of Atreides falls, and your bloodline ends forever.
You can produce the nicest makeup and the most beautiful pieces, but if you don't have an actor that can act in what we do, then it's all for nothing. It's really the actor that makes the makeup become something that is alive.
Fremen, kill them all.
Stellan is so possessed by the darkness of the Baron. Yeah, fantastic performance.
You don't feel wonderful all the time when you're out, but then suddenly something happens, often with another actor, and it swings, and it's music.
Yeah.
Oh, this is what I live for.
I wanted the costume design to be like from another world. Every single little thing had to be designed with the complexity and style.
He didn't want to make a run-of-the-mill sci-fi film. He wanted something more psychological, but it was a big undertaking.
The logistical needs of the film were equal to the creative needs, so we really had to mount a small army to achieve this.
They did over 200 specialty costumes, some of which were very complicated to put together.
I hold at your neck the Gomjabar. Remove your hand from the box and you die.
We looked at tons of medieval references, medieval nuns for the Bene Gesserits. It was a wealth of places from the past to create the future.
One of my favorite images is when the Reverend Mother lands and she walks out of the ship with the following Bene Gesserit women, and they look like scarabs. And it also resembled the harshness of the buildings and the landscape around them.
The Harkonnens had their own colorway. The Atreides had their own colorway. And as we worked with this, we tried to separate those houses.
You never met Harkonnens before. I have. They're not human. They're brutal.
Harkonnens are very bug-inspired, with layers and scales and crests. Even their helmet is very ant-like.
Ugh, the costume is so good. They're some of the coolest things I've ever worn in a film.
I mean, the costumes were gorgeous. The way they fit everyone.
With the Fremen, the minute you put these robes on, there's a certain regality.
The still suit, it's like heavy duty to make something that's just like a gray thing look so beautiful. I don't know how they did it.
There was something about those still suits that were very practical. I felt myself come to when I put it on.
You've worn a still suit before?
No, this is my first time.
Your desert boots are fitted slip fashion at the ankles. Who taught you to do that?
It seemed the right way.
I think that Denis is making a film classic, and I hope people come away with that feeling that I had watching those movies back in the day.
Seeing films of this scope and of this passion, I hope that we've contributed to that in a meaningful way.
What makes this film unique is the total bravery, recklessness, and talent. Denis.
You sit there in a theater and you watch it, you go, what would I really like to hear?
Denis is a very progressive director. He sees the value in sound being part of the whole filmmaking process.
Because in Dune, rhythm is everything. Rhythm is life, and rhythm, most important, can be death.
Usually sound is in what's called post-production, but Denis recognizes the value of developing the soundscape as he's shooting the film and as Joe Walker, the editor, is developing the cut.
So I was collaborating while we were filming the sounds of the worm chase, the sounds of the ornithopters. All these were being developed in tandem with the filming process. And I wanted, as an editor, to be able to build that sound world into this film right from the outset and build, bake it in to the cut.
If you approach it in that way and you're understanding his story and what he's going for, I mean, that's what we try to do with sound. You're not doing the normal stuff. You're really going after mood and character development, things like that, that would make that come alive.
If you want it, make me give it to you. Use the voice.
I think the voice was a big challenge because it had to sound like a real thing. It had to sound natural and not like a synthesizer right. effect.
We came up with this idea of summoning the voices of their ancestors.
Give me a
which order. Would be brought out as he tried to summon his own voice.
It was almost a ghostly voice that could be an ancestral voice of the Bene Gesserit that Paul Atreides would be able to tune into as he grows and evolves and experiences spice.
But I don't think we ever fully felt comfortable with it till maybe the last few days of the sound mix. We were in process for the longest period of time on creating the voice.
Dune is all about the sand, and I felt straight away we're not going to be asking a Foley stage to record this. So the first thing I tried doing was sticking a microphone underneath the sand and walk around it. And I realized that a sand dune is a resonant body. You can hear someone walking 100 meters away. So we then returned to the desert later right. and made a whole bunch of recordings together.
Yeah, we spent an entire day in the desert. Theo, in those early experiments, had captured what we found was a really novel sound that most people aren't aware of, and that is that sand itself in large masses at the right humidity and temperature makes these beautiful whale-like groans. And it almost makes the desert like it's its own character because it has a voice, and we wanted to bring those kinds of sounds to the movie.
So it's really about what does the film need, and that has to be on the top, you know, that carries the day. So if you are telling the story, the film should tell you what it needs.
Sometimes it's tempting to be flashy with sound. Sometimes it's tempting to make a spaceship the loudest, most powerful one you've ever heard. Our aim was to make it feel as if we had really been there and recorded it, as if a documentary crew had a really good sound recordist, to make the world as realistic as possible. We can't go and record an ornithopter. We can't go and record a worm. So we have to design those things, and that brings an aesthetic to the film. It brings a tone to the film, and the tone that we were going for was realism.
That's a tall order for us, to create this fake reality.
It was always trying to kind of balance sound design and music. You don't really know where one ends and the other begins in this film.
In need of a composer, I asked Hans Zimmer if he knew Dune, the book, and Hans answered was that it was probably one of his favorite books of all time. It was one of his biggest dreams to score Dune. So his answer was a big yes.
It was always more about the conversation because I knew the book so well. He knew the book so well. We knew our subject. So now it was figuring out how we were going to interpret something that we truly loved and admired.
I Hans was experimenting and he did tons of experiments. Tons of experiments. He created even instruments. He wanted really to put himself in danger trying to define a new musical language.
Whenever we came across science fiction movies, you'd hear overtly Western instruments, trumpets blaring away and strings, and you go, you know, did this culture really just do what our culture did and build violins and oboes? What's a French horn on Arrakis? And then ended up spending forever making sounds, making instruments, getting people to learn how to play instruments in a different way.
Always bringing new ideas to how to compose music. You know, we feel that everything's been done, but that's not the case.
He kept saying to me, those sounds cannot be heard before. And so he created new instruments, a new musical language. All the score inspired by the sound of the wind and the sound of the wind on the sand and the rhythm too, because rhythm attracts the worm.
There's a rhythm that keeps recurring in the movie, and that is truly not playable by human beings. But because it keeps recurring, it's not random. Do you know what I mean? It's designed. It just doesn't make sense. You know, it's not supposed to make sense. And it was recording a person in a way that you can't normally record them, and treating each syllable separately and differently.
One of the things I love about Hans is that he's part of a long line of German, Austrian composers, and the way that they work of building the smallest organic unit, little cell that could develop into a whole 2.5 hour score.
You know, the book is about these houses, and it's about royalty, and it's about an emperor. It's about where do we come from and where do we go? And it's really just a ginormous watch interlocking with interlocking parts. And so I thought that all the motifs should be able to stand on their own 2 feet, but they should all be able to interlock and create one giant forward motion machine, in a way. Not just a sonic world, but a thematic world.
So he's looking for a piece of music that could be used in any context. It could be slowed down, it could be a romantic version of the theme, it can be a tension version of the theme. It was kind of really magical to see his process.
Part of what I love about the score is how unfamiliar it is. What he did, especially with the voice and understanding sort of where the voice comes from and the ancestors and these different cultures and the blending of these different worlds, it's incredibly exotic, it's emotional, it's intense, it is wholly original and very specific to the film.
Okay, let's try one, okay? 1, 2, 3, 4.
The one thing that we felt would be true through any culture would be the voice. We developed our own language and then made those poor singers do truly impossible things.
Keeping my spot is the hard part.
But luckily, Laura Kotler is one of our singers, the great Lisa Gerard, you know, Susie Waters. They're extraordinary perfectionists. When you throw the impossible at them, that's when they get excited.
I think it's one of the best scores that Hans has ever written. It makes you feel something in different ways that, you know, a more traditional score would fail to do.
So the island to develop me, my friends, if you look at the very first mountain there.
Denis Villeneuve has a grasp on character-driven narrative, small in scope or large in scope. Thanks to the genius of Frank Herbert, here's a story that's on that scale, but with characters and relationships and stories that are dense, you know, and felt. These were the things that made me want to act.
Action.
Guess I'm not in the mood today.
Mood? What does mood have to do with it? Now fight!
part of what makes Dune so great. It's an incredible cast of characters and an incredible cast of actors.
It's very easy to get lost into the concepts, into the scale. But at the end of the day, it's very powerful and complex story.
There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray.
Dune is the story of the Atreides family that falls into the trap set by the Emperor, who is getting more and more jealous of their growing popularity.
House Atreides stands as a beacon where every other house in that galaxy is in reference to that, either as enemies or as friends.
Hold.
What intrigued me about Galito Atreides is the tragic nature of the character. He wants to not only make sure that his people survive, but that his son is the kind of leader that he thinks he should be.
Paul Atreides is the son of Duke Leto and Lady Jessica, and he's the future of House Atreides. He's a young man who's facing extraordinary circumstance, trying to navigate it with integrity within the tradition of House Atreides.
Fremen make these?
Sand compactors and all kinds of ingenious things.
What the hell is a sand compactor?
That's a sand compactor.
Might be odd, man. You've gone native.
Gurney Halleck and Duncan Idaho are close allies of Duke Leto. They feel like big brothers. You know, they rib him, especially Jason.
He's the protector of the Atreides. I mean, he's definitely the head knight who watches over the family.
Sarkar!
I mean, that's his sworn duty. I mean, I think that's what any honorable knight soldier does.
Duncan, no!
I mean, that's his family. That's who he bleeds for.
Gurney Halleck is a combat trainer, he's a warrior, he's a poet warrior.
And he is distrustful of all of it, because he is by nature distrustful, like every security guy you ever see who's looking at things that aren't there.
Your permission, sire, I must check the integrity of your suit.
Oh.
He's a very strict, but fun, visceral, paternal, maternal. He's all of those things to Paul.
You have to be ready.
Paul has all these teachers, and everyone has poured all that they know into this young man.
Tafir Hawat!
Tafir Hawat is a human computer, and I wanted to go away from the cliché of the very cold human being.
He had lived and worked with this family for so long that he had really come to have a dear affection for them.
Your mother asked me to check your vitals.
Dr. Yue is a trusted member of the family. He has served for the Atreides family for a long time. It's a complex and heartbreaking role for an actor to play.
If anything happens, will you protect our son?
With my life.
I'm not asking his mother, I'm asking the Bene Gesserit. Lady Jessica is part of the Order of the Bene Gesserit. This order that she's a part of, we can say we make her perhaps the non-traditional partner to Duke Leto.
The congregation that influence politics from the shadows, that have access to all the leaders, that are counselors and spies for all the leaders in the world.
Come here, kneel.
This group of women who carries enormous strength and powers, they are bodyguards, they are fighters, they can read people.
I hold at your neck the Gomjaba.
One of the strengths that Jessica has is that she's been taught by the Reverend Mother.
The Reverend Mother is interested in Paul because there's a prophecy that a member of the Order of the Bene Gesserit will one day give birth to the One, for lack of a better description. And Paul could perhaps be that person. You're lucky he didn't die in that room.
Jessica is having to deal with being a mother, a lover, and this Bene Gesserit. And she always has to question which priority comes first.
She has her own ambition. It's a very complex, powerful character.
How can the Emperor
take everything we built and give it to that Duke?
Every movie needs its bad guys, and the Harkonnens are the old ancestral enemies of the Atreides.
The Harkonnen are a family that have controlled the spice for many generations.
Frank Herbert created a very powerful character into Baron Vladimir Harkonnen.
Just shows up, and then his shadow looms throughout the film. He's the cause of many people's death.
Raban is the nephew of the Baron, and he is a very sadistic and mean.
not the smartest guy. Raban really wants to please his uncle, and the Baron looks at Raban as more of a pawn, and doesn't really feel much for him.
Peter DeVries is the mentat of the Harkonnen family. He's been twisted by the Baron Harkonnen. He's kind of strung Peter out, and Peter is so devoted to this cause of retaining the Harkonnen control of the spice.
So squeeze, Rabbit. Squeeze hard.
Yes, Uncle. And the vermin.
Kill them all.
The vermin are native tribes. People living in the deep desert. They had the capacity to adapt to the toughest environment. Deep heat, massive sandstorm, dangerous predators all around.
Dilgar is the leader of the Fremen. He is a powerful character. He's a warrior, but also he's a warrior. He worries about the future.
Take good care of your family.
Dr. Kynes, on the surface, was seemingly just somebody who's an ecologist, someone who cares about the Fremen. But then you start to understand how much pressure she is actually under just to keep everything contained and controlled.
Who are you to the Fremen?
Paul is dreaming about this strange young woman that keeps talking to him in his dreams.
Paul.
She feels like an old friend again and someone that wants to guide him.
Don't be frightened. Eva and her little desert mouse can survive.
Jani is native to Arrakis. She's used to this hostility between her people and the people that are trying to take from her land. She's a fighter at the end of the day. When she does meet Paul, her guard is up. She looks at this person as like, this is a child.
But there's clearly something else. There's a glimmer of something between them.
I don't believe you're the Lisan al-Gaib, but I want you to die with honor.
It's indescribable what that feeling would be of a proximity of physical attraction in dream form that comes with a terrible purpose. It comes with a very intense actualization. So I think Shani represents all those things to him.
And it seems that he truly cares about the people, and there's a deeper humanity within him.
They're on a path of conflict, and it's the moral catalyst to Paul's arc towards something greater.
Desert power.
This is only the beginning.
House Atreides. The noble house of Atreides, scions of kings, gods, and legends alike. This great people is descended from Atreus, Greek god of war, and King Agamemnon, ruler of Mycenae and storied warrior of the Trojan War on Earth. Like their forebearers, members of House Atreides are born rulers. Their green and black crest a shining beacon of the galaxy. They are viewed as friends of enemies, but never discounted, and rarely unconsidered.
We are House Atreides. There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray.
For generations, they called the planet of Caladan home, the third planet in orbit around star Delta Pavonis. Much of its surface is covered in vast oceans, allowing for aquatic ecosystems to flourish. During the Duchy of House Atreides, terrestrial agriculture thrived, as did fishing industries. It was considered a time of prosperity on Caladan. In the year 10,191 AG, in the waning days of Duke Leto Atreides' rule, House Atreides was charged with taking control of the desert planet Arrakis, forcing Duke Atreides, along with his son and heir to the title Paul Atreides, to lead a massive exodus from their ancestral home on Caladan. The Atreides' takeover of Arrakis ended 80 years of tyrannical rule by House Harkonnen and sparked conflict between the two great houses that persists to this day.
Atreides! Atreides!
The Bene Gesserit. A powerful force, both politically and spiritually, the Bene Gesserit are a sisterhood of skilled and highly trained women with expertise in a wide array of fields, including espionage, theology, and sciences. While they possess deep knowledge and wisdom, they also wield physical power with unique fighting tactics known as the Wielding Way, and a powerful vocal skill known as the Voice. In fact, Bene Gesserit, who have mastered the Voice, can bend any person to their will.
Come here, kneel.
The Bene Gesserit possess many additional powers related to their physical body, giving them complete control of their reproductive system, their breathing, and their metabolisms, allowing them, for example, to render toxins harmless. One of the Bene Gesserit's missions is to fulfill an ancient prophecy, creating a unique being that will lead to the betterment of all mankind. They do not sit idly by and wait for this superior being to appear, but rather they take an active role. For thousands of years, the Bene Gesserit carefully cross bloodlines to create this superior being. They call this chosen one the Kwisatz Haderach, the first male Bene Gesserit.
For thousands of years, we've been carefully crossing bloodlines to bring forth a mind powerful enough to bridge space and time.
One member of the Bene Gesserit, Lady Jessica of the Atreides, is thought to have prematurely taken this task upon herself against the wishes of the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother. Using the Gom Jabbar was the first step in uncovering whether her intentions were fruitful. Despite their enigmatic motivations, one thing is clear. The Bene Gesserit have their own agenda, and anyone who has dealings with them would be wise to remember it. Fremen. It is impossible to speak of the Fremen without also speaking of their home world of Arrakis, for much of their culture has been built around adapting to the harsh environment of their desert planet. The scarcity of water on Arrakis makes this world uninhabitable for anyone unable to adapt. The Fremen have evolved in this hostile environment, the lack of water leading to great conservation skills and a near worship of this life-sustaining substance. A core tenet of Fremen beliefs is that any given individual's water does not belong solely to them, but rather to the entire tribe.
What wealth can you offer beyond the water in your flesh?
The Fremen have also developed a wide array of technologically advanced equipment to help them thrive on Arrakis, such as the still suits they wear to conserve and reclaim water from the body. Making their homes in the natural caverns of the dry planet, called sieges, the Fremen share their world with sandworms, commonly referred to as Shai-Hulud. They consider this immense creature a tangible representation of God, and their relationship with it is a key component of their culture. The spice found on Arrakis is a significant part of the Fremen diet, contributing to their blue eye color, universal amongst them. The Fremen largely seek to maintain distance from outside political machinations, but this is not always possible, as evidenced by a storied meeting between Duke Leto Atreides and a Fremen leader known as Stilgar. Heir to the house, Paul Atreides would later meet with Charni, a member of Stilgar's siege. With their tight-knit communities and specific rites and rituals, it is a significant challenge for any outsider to be fully embraced by the Fremen. The spice melange. On the planet of Arrakis exists a substance so valuable, so rare, and so necessary to our way of life, that countless people have toiled, bled, and even died to harvest this natural resource. It is the spice melange. And control of its production grants immense wealth and power to whichever house claims it. One of its most common uses is space travel, for without spice, navigators would be lost amongst the stars. It also contains vast health benefits and mind-altering properties, making it a key component of the diet and culture belonging to Arrakis natives, referred to as the Fremen. Said to taste slightly of cinnamon, the spice is also highly addictive. One of the greatest challenges to the harvesting of spice is the Shai-Hulud, or sandworm, native to Arrakis. Dangerous beasts, they lurk beneath the surface of the dunes and attack at the slightest tremor from above. But these creatures are also integral to the production of spice, as it's excretions from their larval form that allow spice to exist at all. With all this wealth buried beneath the sands of Dune, it is no wonder that conflict plagues this unique land of spice, and will likely continue to do so, even into the future.
Paul reluctantly training with Gurney Alec. Gurney tries a bit like right at the beginning of the movie to warn him, to wake him up.
It's rude.
When you first see Gurney with Paul, it's more of a professor-teacher thing where you're seeing moves. You're in this place where you're like, okay, you're supposed to be ta 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 ta.
What we shot first, those were my first 3 days. But on those days, Josh was captain, you know, had done combat sequences like that. And true to the nature of the scene, he's the weapons master, so he took the lead.
Oh, man.
Roger Yuan was the choreographer who came up with most of the movement in Dune.
Gurney is coming in kind of playfully and yet wanting to teach this young man that where he's going, it's serious. And so the training sequence, it's a choreographed set of the basic blocks, but which are functional in real-world fighting.
You have to combination of very fast move, a bit like a chess player that does several moves in advance in order to kill the king. It's the same thing.
I guess I'm not in the mood today.
Mood? What's mood to do with it?
And once Timothy's character says, I'm not in the mood, that's where it becomes a real fight.
You fight when the necessity arises, no matter your mood. Now fight!
It's a cross mix between martial arts and fencing, where you do a certain amount of movement to distract the opponent in order to be able to bring the blade inside his shield.
Ah, the slow blade penetrates the shield.
So it's a very fast, fast pacing, close combat, very precise, using hands, both hands and knives, in order to be able to kill the opponent. It's a very specific technique that belongs to Doom.
Now you can take it away and just send it.
Okay, so if that is, you mean like that?
Yeah.
The Atreides system I based on a Kali, and a specific style of Kali, Balintawak, which is very, very short movements because their blades are shorter. So it adapts to that type of weaponry. Depending upon the character and also the actor that is brought in, I would love to make sure that their specific abilities physically are being utilized. What was their background? Even if it's not martial arts, do they understand tennis? Do they play soccer? And try to, in their training process, relate to them in that way first, and then kind of slowly guide them along and go, okay, this is how we do it in fight world now.
It took a while, but learning kata fighting with the sticks, you know, and filming myself and then looking at it and actually learning from it and saying, oh, I see I'm too far forward and I need to stand up more, and things clicking along the way.
Josh is great. I had a great, great time with him personally, as well as showing him the choreography.
Because you want to show the effect of the sword going in, let them drop to their knees, and then decide to cut.
It's a fight that was very difficult for me to learn because I'm just more, I mean, look at me, man. You know, it's just like there's no... You know what I mean? The silverback. So I pushed myself very, very, very hard.
Roger Yuan, we worked very hard together, and I have big gratitude to him.
Timothy was great. He had a little bit of a background in Taekwondo. He's got a dance background, so he has a wonderful memory for choreography. I said, look, do everything slow motion. Let your body feel connected so that it's not just a mechanical movement of arm and shoulder. It's that your whole body and your mind and intent of what you're doing, that's combined. Then we can go into doing it fast.
It was quite beautiful to see them evolving through time and being to be able to achieve that kind of level of mastery.
I have you.
But look down, my lord. You're to join me in death. I see you found the mood.
What would you do if your ornithopter went down out here?
You wouldn't want to go down out there. It's worm territory.
Spice is to Dune what oil is to our world. The sandworm goes in the deep desert and attacks the spice harvester because they are a territorial beast and they want to protect the spice fields.
The harvester is like a rolling factory. We always started designs on what would it really look like. Like if you were really on a futuristic planet full of sand and you had to extract something that was embedded in sand and filter it through, how would you really do that? The challenge was to make that look interesting. I didn't want this to be an oil rig with tank treads on it. When I first started with this harvester, Denis asked me, how would it be extracting the spice? How is it moving? Is it crawling on legs like a spider? Is that too futuristic? Is it working on treads? One of the hardest parts of my job is to making something look interesting.
I think we were all expecting that it was going to be 120 degrees and it was going to be miserable and we're in these still suits and these rubber suits and you're just dying and you're running out in the middle of the sun. And it wasn't. It was very mild and it was fun.
It was pure fun because at the end of the day, that is the moment where Paul will be for the very first time of his life in contact with the deep desert and will strangely feel home.
Go, 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 go!
There was a moment Paul is kneeling in front of the spice harvester. Denis wanted the kneeling in front of it to be really specific.
Denis is incredibly conscientious about everyone and about the performers and checking in and making sure things are working well. He just knows how to bring the best out of them.
The sequence has to be very carefully timed, and there's a big consequence if you hold onto a shot for too long. It's, you know, the dollar signs start going up. We very carefully crafted that. It was a collaboration really between me and Denny, but also with Sam Hudecki, the storyboard artist, that we would compare notes and try and kind of get the thing in really good shape.
The scene where you see Paul and Gurney on the back of the ramp and they're like watching the worm take the spice crawler. They're actually on the ramp and like we actually pulled the ornithopter up on a crane.
It's a scene that required a lot of choreography, a lot of time of shooting, but honestly, those are my favorite thing because it's a sequence that doesn't rely on dialogues or something. It just relies on cinema and the power of the images, and we had great time shooting that.
Throw sound. Rolling.
Duncan Idaho is one of the greatest swordmaster in the galaxy.
Duncan is who you want by your side when you're in the foxhole.
Jason Momoa is a beast. He do his fighting sequence like a dancer.
Ready?
Bang, low, go!
There you go.
He loves to fight. He loves the choreography. I think it's his favorite part. At one point, Duncan was trying to save the Duke, Lady Jessica and Paul. He fails, he arrives too late, but it's the moment where we will witness for the first time Duncan's fighting skills that are closer to the samurai, and it's a choreography that had been done by Roger Yuan.
Jason came in, he's got a fight background that I recognize.
That's a cut right there, and then you're pinning into the arm. So this is the catch.
He trained with Chad Stahelski, who's a good friend of mine.
Jason Momoa is Duncan Idaho. He's just an ass kicker.
The big fight is about 19 stuntmen that's at the same time, which I've never done before. Fought a lot of dudes, but not like they're all in a hallway. We've spent a lot of time training for it.
And then into the back, back, back. So if you have a guy come in, block, and flex.
I realized, okay, this is just about fine-tuning. He knew what techniques that he liked to do, what he's comfortable doing, what stances, and I tried to match it in.
Roger had a certain technique that he brought in, and there's some collie moves that I've never really done before. There's a lot of things I can't do in this movie that only stuntmen can do. That's what's so special about them. They risk their lives for the craft, for the art, for myself.
And he really wanted to see romantic moments that hearkened from the past. And so this is why he's chosen a sword-based weapon. There's something heroic and interesting about that.
Saw the camera left right there.
That's good, Dad.
Sarko.
That's good, Dad.
Duncan is crazy, passionate, and somebody that Paul really looks up to and wishes he could be.
Duncan, no!
His energy is also contagious on set, off set.
Reloads the door.
These are guys that have worked all over the world, so they know how to bring in energy.
Sarkar! Right.
Okay. All right, shooting. We're all sound.
Rolling.
Smooth, Jay, you got it.
Split.
Set. And 3, 2, 1, go.
My love was death. At night, looks up to the family, and I was honored to play the role. It's really cool because Denis doesn't really get to do those kind of action pieces, and so to see the excitement and like things that necessarily I've done, but it's through his lens, through Greg's lighting, when I go and look at it, I'm like, wow, just a total different experience, which is beautiful.